The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 448 for Sunday, May 5th, 2013.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer questions. We also answer questions. We share tips and share cool stuff found here on a holiday that I'll call Geeko de Mayo, John. I'm Dave Hamilton in Durham, New Hampshire.
Oh, that's bad. That's bad. And here in, spring is just everywhere. Oh, man, the trees are flowering. The weather I was just taking a stroll earlier today, but perfect weather. This is New England.
You know what? It's funny. I said that to Lisa earlier this week, too, because we've had perfect weather pretty much, you know, a lot this week. I said, I really love it here this time of year. This, you know, my favorite weather. I said that, you know, this is really a great time to be in New England. And she said to me, you know, in San Diego, it's like this all year round. Like, OK, thanks. Yep. Appreciate that.
Well, on the one hand, I like it. But on the other hand, the variety is nice. Maybe not so much the hot, but the snow. I do like the snow in the winter stuff. But the thing I got to do is tell you who I am, which in Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
That's right. You are John F. Braun. Yeah, no, I agree. When we lived in Austin in Texas, I missed the change of season. I mean, I grew up here in New England, obviously, and I really missed. Like, I like this time of year because it's a change. It's different from the winter and it's that nice kind of thing. But I also like when we have basically the same weather in the fall. But enough about the weather, right? Can we start the show here?
Mm-hmm.
Am I allowed?
All right.
Sean writes, hey guys, I finally have a question for you. I'm a developer and I work on both Mac and Windows. My Windows laptop is a new Dell, which has a mini display port for its external monitor port. I have my 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro and the Dell hooked up to my 24-inch Cinema Display via a Kinex KVM switch, which handles mini DisplayPort. My problem is I like to have apps like Mailplane, ADM Tweetbot, etc. on my laptop's internal screen when it's hooked up to the Cinema Display. But if I switch away using the KVM to the Dell and then later switch back to the external display, all those apps migrate to the Cinema Display. Is there any app that will remember where Windows should be, what screen, what location, and what window size when a given external monitor is plugged in and make it happen? And there is. In fact, there are multiple apps, Sean. And I racked my brain trying to remember the one that we had talked about in the past and that I used to use when I had a MacBook Pro in my office, but I honestly couldn't remember it. However, I'm pretty sure it was an app called Stay. That's available in the Mac App Store. If it wasn't, that's still there, but there's another one called DisplayMade as well. So Stay or DisplayMade will do exactly what you're asking for. They're smart enough to know. In fact, they're smart enough to know if you use one monitor at home and a different monitor at work, for example, they'll know that there's a difference between those two monitors and remember your arrangements differently, I should say. So there you go. That's how I call it, John.
I'm with you.
Yeah. It's a good thing. You know, it's a good question and a good thing to know about as more and more of us wind up using external monitors. So there you go. What do you got, John?
I'm gonna have to dig around here because there's another one that comes to mind here, so I'll try to do that while.
Okay.
You're doing the next thing. Right now, I got to pick something up here. In that we should probably go to Tony.
Yeah, go.
Do you think?
I thought.
All right, Tony asked this question, and he actually got back to me, which was great. But anyway, so Tony is saying, "Hi guys, today's question." Not yesterday's, not tomorrow's, but today's question is, how can I read and write to NTFS partitions on the Mac? I have an external disk which is formatted as NTFS, and I always use it on Windows, but sometimes I want to save things to it for my Mac here at home. Do you have any tips on how to do it? Regards, Tony. Yes. So number one, how can you read NTFS? Well, that as far as I know, Dave, is still built into OS X, is the ability to read NTFS. And actually, let's step back a moment here. What is NTFS, you may ask?
You read my
NTFS.
Mind.
NTFS. So first, NTFS. This is a Microsoft, I guess the best way to put it is a partition scheme for a hard drive. Similar to, you know, so you have on the Mac, you have a few different ones here. What can we do on our Mac, Dave?
Well, we can do HFS plus, right?
Right, so HFS is the base. So HFS plus. Yeah.
And I wouldn't call it a partition scheme. I would actually call it a file system. I mean, I realize it's a self-referential acronym at that point. But that's what it is, because a partition scheme is one step above that, right? It's a way to format a given partition.
Right. I guess the best way, so where you would see this, if I'm not mistaken here, so if you do highlight a hard drive on your machine and to do the whole get info here, it'll list the format. So in this case here, I have Mac OS extended journaled.
Yep.
Is the format of my drive. And I guess NTFS is just another type of drive format. But here, so the good news is that Mac OS X can read NTFS. Here's the bad news, is that normally it cannot write it.
And NTFS is the default on Windows now, right? It is what Windows prefers to use.
It's what they suggest, because you can incorporate security, and I think it's mostly you can do finer grained security with NTFS versus something like FAT. FAT32, FAT16, whatever. I guess those don't lend themselves to as tight control over security.
Yeah, not nearly as tight, actually.
Yeah. Right. But it's more common, and especially like, you know, flash drives and stuff, I think typically are in FAT32, which is nice because then you can bop between different machines.
Totally.
So the advice here is that, well, there are two options, Dave. So one is you can do the freebie, and I actually found an outstanding blog entry here. So as I started doing research, I found someone who had already gone through the steps that I was going to go through. It's Sam Alston's blog.
All right.
And the title of the post here, which is fairly recent, February 14th, 2013, is Write Support for NTFS with Mac OS X Mountain Lion.
Okay, perfect.
Well, that's pretty timely. And he goes through the steps here, and at a high level, of course, we'll link to this in our notes here, but you want to get first something called Mac Fuse, which is a open source deal that lets you manipulate the file system of drives, or load in different ones, not just the standard ones. Then you download and install something called NTFS 3G, which I guess bolts onto that. Then you got to get some a bug fix. Then you got to get another bug fix, and then open this utility. And then so he goes through all the steps here. So that's the hard way, but it's the free way. And then, Dave, the other one that I found here, and you and I have known about this for a while, and I think I wasn't aware that they made a breakthrough here as far as pricing, because I consider this a breakthrough in pricing, but Paragon Software often comes up, and they make something called NTFS for Mac. And the current product is called NTFS for Mac OS X, which I guess is version 10 of their product, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is, Dave, I didn't know this, but so first, I believe you can get a 30-day trial of this, but Dave, it's only $20.
Seriously?
I seem to recall it being a little more expensive, but I'm looking right here at the link, and it says here, actually, it's $19.95. It's not even $20.
Wow. It's definitely cheaper than it used to be. I
think that drove
that
a lot
too.
Of people away. I mean, yeah. For me, Dave, I mean, to get NTFS functionality for $20, I mean, that's a no-brainer. But I think in the past, it used to be more, maybe 50, 60, 70.
I thought so, it was too. Yeah. And it's fast.
That's the thing, is that, it is a commercial product. The free product, that's the only downside. The free product is slow, but it's free. So there you go. So if you got $20 and NTFS writing is important to you and reading, I guess, then that's the way to go. And I actually wrote back and he said, he got the trial and it's great. And I think he already threw down the money for it, because it's the best way to go.
I've always stayed Paragon. I think they even sent us free codes for it, and I never installed it other than just to test it. But I always felt like, wow, you know, I don't want to rely on a file system. And I realized I wouldn't use it as my main file system, but I didn't even want to like get in the path of using a file system like this that's not directly supported by my Mac. You know, the last thing I want is to have data on a disk that I can't access because I don't have some third party software or, you know, OS 10 Lion or, you know, OS 10, whatever it is, Russian Blue 10.9 comes out and now Paragon doesn't work or whatever. And they've been good about it. It's not, I don't mean anything about them, but just, you know, third party software to get at my data scares me. But you make a good point. OS 10 for a long time now has been able to read NTFS. No problem. Just can't write to it. So maybe I need to rethink my my hesitation on NTFS these days. Yeah. So anyway, there you go. That's the foray into the thought train of Dave Hamilton, whether you wanted it or not.
Great. Now, the other thought here is that what if you want to go in the opposite direction? They have a product for this as well. I don't know if you were thinking, John, is there some excuse me, but there must be Windows people that want to read HFS, right?
Yes, totally.
You would imagine. So, yeah. And actually I look right here. Huh? Look at this. Now these guys have, wow. Okay. So they have another product called HFS Plus for Windows. Full access to Mac HFS Plus from Windows. Because as far as I know, Windows in no way, shape or form supports HFS. It's just like, huh?
Right.
Or I haven't tried it lately, but this product is also $19.95. So what a deal.
Awesome. Okay.
So yeah. I got to say, and I haven't heard any negative things about these guys other than that they charge money for their products.
But that's not a negative, right?
And that looks to be less of a problem now. Because again, I think you and I recall their products being pricier.
Yep.
So,
yep.
They're not one, but two answers.
Awesome. Good stuff. That's a, well, that's a wrap. Let's do it. It's time for dinner, right?
We have more answers.
Oh, we do.
Well, we have more questions and more answers.
That's what happens.
But not just that, Dave. I think we have
sponsors and they help make what we do here possible. So it is important for us to tell you about them. And I love the stable of all of our sponsors that we have now, because it's stuff that makes sense for the show, things that make sense to talk about and things that we're happy to talk about. And very squarely on that list is Smile at smilesoftware.com with Text Expander. Text Expander is one of, you've heard me say this before, but it truly is. It's one of those apps I cannot live without on pretty much any Mac I use. It's if I set up a new Mac, you know, reinstall OS 10 and put, you know, start using it within probably an hour, I will have installed Text Expander because I just can't live without it. Now, you ask, what does it do? Well, Text Expander, in a nutshell, allows you to take long snippets of text, but they don't have to be that long. They can be anything. You can do a phone number. You can do an address. You can do five paragraphs. You can do three pages and put them in Text Expander and then assign a tiny little shortcut to it. And when you type the tiny little shortcut, it's automatically replaced with whatever your other text was. Now, this doesn't have to be just text. You can have formatting in there. You can have images in there and you can have form fields. So I have conditionals, like, for example, my email signature. Sometimes I want to sign my email with my cell phone and sometimes I want to sign it with my office phone. And so I could create two separate signatures to do that. But now I can create one signature. And when I type it, boom, it comes up and I've got it to give me a drop down and I pick which one I want and off it goes. I use the same thing for the chat room here. When we finish the show, I want to put a little note as the header in our chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream that indicates when we're going to be back for the next show. And so I do this and now I have it creates the text for me. But I have, I believe, three fields that I can fill in, one with the date, one with the time and one with the show number that it's going to be. So the next one, of course, would be, you know, 449. And it just makes it so easy because it's stuff I have to type regularly. I don't want to have to think about typing. It totally saves me from making typos, and it makes sure that the data is right. You know, I've said it before, John, sometimes people say, I want to send you guys, you know, X, Y, or Z for review. What's John's address? Well, I don't have your address memorized. I have mine memorized, but it doesn't mean I like to type it. So I have both of our addresses in there and I can just pop them out and make it work. So it's definitely a cool thing. Definitely a cool way, a great tool to get your work done. And it's, as I said, one I couldn't live without. So I'm very happy to have them here as a sponsor. Go check it out. SmileSoftware.com. You can download a free trial from there and test it out. And I highly encourage you to do that. And then when it's, when you've decided that you can't live without it either, and I'm sure you will, take $35, go back to Smile Software, buy it. You'll get a nickel back, $34.95. Text Expander is yours. You're a happier person. SmileSoftware.com. And we'd like to thank them. All right, John, what's next? Oh, we got this one next, don't we? All right. Let me pull up Mark's question here, because this is one of my favorite things to talk about. Well, you know, because it's fun.
Home networking, of course.
It is home networking. That's right. So Mark writes, he says, I'm considering upgrading the Ethernet switch for our home network. When we built our house in 2004, we installed Ethernet cables. So we have 22 Ethernet outlets spread around the house. Up until today, our 8-port switch was sufficient. But with the addition of a second Apple TV, there are no longer any free ports anywhere in the house. Our network now consists of our DSL router, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It had been convenient to have an available port for a laptop to do software upgrades, file transfers, et cetera, over a wired connection versus Wi-Fi. For what it's worth, our current switch is a D-Link 8-port gigabit switch. A quick look at Amazon and Monoprice seems to indicate that the next step is up to 16 ports. Is this the case? Any shopping tech advice you could offer would be greatly appreciated. Okay, so let's go through
first,
this. Go ahead.
I just made an observation here, and I'm a bit confused at the beginning here. So it says we have 22 Ethernet outlets.
Yeah.
Are you reading this as that he has the potential to have 22 port switch? Not that such a thing exists, but
right.
Are you getting what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
Are these ports all individual ports where if he had a switch with more ports, then everything would be great?
He has in 22
and then right
different,
now he has an 8-port switch.
Correct. In 22 different places in his home, he has an Ethernet jack on the wall. And every one of those Ethernet jacks all snakes back to one place, one
so
central
ideally,
location.
Ideally, we should have a 22-port. If someone made a 22-port switch, that would be the ideal solution.
Yeah, okay. Because he could then plug all of these in and all of them would be live. But right now he's only ever used 8 simultaneously. And so he plugs those 8 into the switch and he's really been using 7 with one extra. And he's presumably made that extra somewhere that it's convenient for him to plug in a laptop.
All I got to say before you answer the question is hats off for wiring your home with all those Ethernet ports. That's brilliant.
It is brilliant.
That's something everybody should do.
It totally is. And it's cheap when you're building. Totally cheap when you're building.
Because I'm saying doing it after the fact, especially like I have an older house here built at the beginning of the 1900s, is installing anything like central air conditioning. Forget it.
Or you'd be surprised.
I suppose I could. Well, actually, you know, in my house, I do have RG whatever cable running to every room that it was wired with both phone line, which is essentially useless. But it's also every room has a cable connector. So at least somebody was forwarded in that respect.
Anyway, so yes, the next step up would be a 16-port switch. And the pricing increase, it's not debilitating, but percentage-wise, it's a pretty big step. Sometimes you can buy 2 8-port switches cheaper than a 16. And then from the next step up, which would be enough for our friend Mark here, is to a 24-port switch. And that then gets even more expensive. You can, you know, it's because of the way the tech works. But 16 ports is still relatively affordable. But I will throw out the option. You already have an 8-port switch. You could buy, and we're going to explain why you might want to do this or why you might not, but you could buy a second 8-port switch and bridge the two together by plugging an Ethernet cable between the two switches. You sacrifice some performance, which I'm going to explain, but you can save, depending on how you set it up. Yeah. You sacrifice some performance, but you can obviously save some money because you already have one 8-port switch and the performance might not be an issue. So the best way I can explain the way a switch works is to first explain its predecessor, which was called a hub. A hub, and I'm going to call it 100 megabits per second, but the same would apply to gigabit if there was such a thing as a gigabit hub. But the philosophy and the the science is the same. A 100 megabit hub had 100 megabits of bandwidth to share amongst all of its ports. So a 4-port hub had 100 megabits of bandwidth to share. An 8-port hub had 100 megabits of bandwidth to share. So back to our 4-port hub. If you have that and you plug in 4 devices and device number 1 is talking to device number 2, that will happen theoretically at 100 megabits. But if then while 1 and 2 were talking, if the device plugged into 3 wanted to talk to device number 4, that connection would eat half of the bandwidth from the first one. And now each of them would be essentially sharing that 100 megabits. So, 50 megabits per second for each of those two connections. With a switch, each port, and we're going to go with a 100 megabit switch just to keep our math the same.
I think it was even worse, Dave.
Yeah, it was. But
hubs.
Yeah, but hang on. Let me get through this, and then if you want to get esoteric about it, we can. But I'm trying to stay. Well, I'm trying to stay simple here, because you're right. There's more to it than this. But I'm trying to sort of get an overview. With a switch, each port has 100 megabits, and a 100 megabit switch has 100 megabits dedicated to it. That means in the aforementioned scenario, each connection would be able to talk at full 100 megabits. Same is true of a gigabit switch. So each connection could have had a gigabit of bandwidth. Most connections that we're doing don't get to a gigabit worth of bandwidth because the place from which you're getting data from or sending data to, which a lot of times is going to be hard drives, can't pump data out that fast. Some can, RAID units and things like that. But otherwise, no, they can't. So what you could do is if you take that, you could plug, a cable from your existing 8-port switch into a new switch. Now, a new 8-port switch. Now, that means that you've taken one port out of each switch. So you're now down to 14 ports. And if you're smart about it, you can say, hey, the things that need to talk to each other a lot, I'm going to put on one switch or another and limit the amount of things that are going to need to talk from switch to switch, and your bandwidth is going to be pretty good. The bridge between the switches still gets a full gigabit, but if you've got three things constantly talking across that, well, then now they're each limited to 300 megabits. Even that might be enough. And for most of us in our home networks, it's fine. My home network is probably 6 8-port switches spread all around because of convenience, and it's what I had, and I never have a problem because it's just the way it works. So I just get the, if I were in your shoes, I'd get another 8-port switch. They're cheap. You can get them for like $20 and you're good to go. So there you go. Now you want to get esoteric, John? It's all yours. Thank you.
I don't like that word. No, the only thing I'll say is that a hub was one of the first devices. And at the time it seemed clever, but the problem with a hub, to try to crystallize it, a hub, the problem is that when it gets data and it tries to send it to other people that are plugged into it, it sends it to everybody. It broadcasts it. And that's dumb, but that's how hubs work.
Right. Right.
Switches.
I will point out one thing before we get too esoteric. You're not going to buy hubs anymore. No one, they don't even sell them. So it's
If there's one sitting around somewhere, I mean, it's better than nothing. But the only point I want to make is that hubs, as you start increasing usage, because they're not smart enough to direct traffic between two individual ports. And that's the basic problem.
Yeah.
A hub doesn't know how to do that. A switch does. You'll still have broadcast packets, which a switch will say, OK, well, I'll broadcast it to everybody. But if a switch sees traffic from one port to another, it's not going to broadcast it to everybody else. And that's the problem with the hub. So stay away from hubs, I think, is the general advice here.
Yeah, you're going to do that anyway. I really wanted to use it to explain how the switch works. So, what the limitation is of bridging the 8-port switches. You're putting this 1 gigabit link between the two switches, which is plenty fast.
Well, I think you laid it out properly, is that the only bottleneck is potentially if there's tons of traffic going between one switch and the other.
Yeah. But, if you've
if there's a lot of local traffic, then it's a good decision. I would still just get a 16 port one or a 24. But
yeah. Yeah. But it's again,
but if funds are tight, then bridging two is good.
It's fine. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Ralph.
And I will answer a question. In fact, first I'll say hello to everyone in our chat room. Hello. Hello. To everyone in our chat room at macgeekab.com/stream. And I'm not going to pronounce your name because it's got numbers and letters, but in the chat room asks, aren't a switch and a router the same sort of thing, or are they totally different? Mm. A router typically has a switch built in. You'll see oftentimes, you know, a router with a 4-port switch. If it has 4 Ethernet ports, it's got a switch built into it. The old airport extremes, base stations didn't have a switch in them. They had one port, and you could then plug that into a switch if you chose. But the new ones have, you know, 4 ports or whatever. So you go.
Well, to me, a router includes an additional level of intelligence that a switch does not.
Oh, well, the router is a separate thing, and then the router sometimes has a switch in it. Yes, the router does.
Well, they all have to. Well, they do port-to-port traffic.
They don't have to. That's what I'm saying, is the first airports really did not have a switch in them. No, they had one Ethernet port. That was it.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah, that's all.
But all modern ones. But there's different functions here. Is that, yeah, a switch is dumb. It doesn't have to do any... A router has a higher level of, I guess to me, the thing that a router does is that it involves at least an additional level of network translation that a switch doesn't.
Absolutely.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Because it's taking your network traffic and routing it, you know, over your cable modem or your DSL or whatever it's doing. That's right.
And from the chat room, how much better is Ethernet than Wi-Fi? Ethernet is always better. So,
well, no. I mean,
just giving a quick answer here.
Yeah, but it's not true. If you need a wireless connection to your if you need to get your iPhone online, Ethernet sucks because it can't do it, you know. So, there you go.
But as far as the speed, though, actually, I hear about the 802.11ac is coming out, and that's something we'll call a gigabit wireless. Oh, okay.
I've had it for a long time.
It's not quite gigabit. It's close.
We talked about Buffalo's. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. It's good. It's still a beta draft thing, but
yeah,
it's coming, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't have any clients for it. Yeah.
I want to hear what Ralph has to say. I think we all do. So Ralph says, "Hey guys, I'm a new listener, a lifelong geek. Outstanding. And I love your show. Listen to every episode. I bought a new MacBook Pro in December, 16 gigs RAM, 2.3 gigahertz Core i7, running Mountain Lion 10.8.3. I love this machine. I like my Macs to run well. However, I'm having some issues when it wakes from sleep when I open the lid. For security purposes, I have the login screen enabled. When the machine has been sleeping for only a short time, it normally fires back up no problem, as responsive and snappy as I would expect and want from a brand new MacBook Pro with plenty of hard drive and RAM. But when the machine has been asleep for many hours, such as overnight, about 1 out of 4 times, it stumbles on waking up. Screen is frozen black, keyboard trackpad unresponsive. The light on the front body goes solid as opposed to sleeping pulse, but nothing else. Sometimes the login screen will appear after many seconds, but it too is usually frozen at first. I even had the login appear frozen, then go back to black, then reappear." So other crazy stuff there. But I think that summarizes it. He's having problems. He's having intermittent wake-up problems.
Mm-hmm.
My response to him is one item, but then I have another in the back of my head here. But I basically said, "Hi, Ralph. It sounds like resetting the SMC is a good place to start, because in the list of symptoms listed in Apple support article, Intel-based Macs resetting the system management controller, one thing they refer to is why you'd want to reset the SMC is that you're having problems sleeping or waking up." So that's really what I had.
Yeah, I would. It's the first thing to do. Yeah. I mean, hopefully that's it. This is one of those things that, you know, appears to be a hardware issue. And when that happens, SMC reset and even a PRAM reset is the right thing, because that can often solve those things.
I was going to suggest that. The only thing, Dave, is that PRAM, I don't know if PRAM has anything to do with power management settings.
It doesn't, but it doesn't hurt. That's all. I agree with you. It probably won't do anything.
Because I was going to suggest it, but I held back resetting the PRAM certainly can't hurt. I think the worst thing that will happen is you may upset the date time.
Yeah, but that gets set automatically.
Yeah, now it does. But if that's broken, then.
Yep. We've got MacWorks. Chris from MacWorks in the chat room says his retina on 1083 started having issues with waking up in the morning. Genius Bar told him to turn off Time Machine, and that worked. So, which tells me it could be part of the how come I can't think of the name of it? The sleep thing where it runs Time Machine and things like that in the while the computer's asleep. Power nap could be an issue with power nap. So definitely try that. That's a great solution. Thanks, Chris. Yeah. Good stuff.
And then another one.
Yeah.
So we're just knocking them out of the park here. So Richard, I think we want to do Richard.
Yeah. More sleep problems.
Everybody has sleep problems.
Yeah. You know,
good morning, guys. I have a question on my MacBook Pro mid 2012. I received this laptop in fall of last year from work. Yay. That's awesome. Must be a cool place to work. And I have been putting it to sleep most of the time, either by keyboard shortcut or by closing the lid. Up until about a month ago, whenever I would wake it from sleep, it would essentially immediately recover from sleep and I would log in and be on my way. About a month ago, the MacBook Pro is acting differently. More times than not, when it recovers from sleep, the screen is grayed out and you can see the desktop, but it's milky, if you will. A progress bar will show at the bottom and it will take about 30 plus seconds to fully recover so that I can type my password. What could be causing this change in behavior? I've shut down from time to time throughout this and I've not changed it. Any help would be appreciated. Dave, I think I know exactly what the problem is. I don't know why it happened, but I know what it is.
Yep.
And I think you do too.
Yep.
But you're going to let me go with it. Somehow your machine is now waking from hibernate mode. What is hibernate mode? And I believe this is the way the Mac is initially configured when you get it. So on portables, what happens is when you put the machine to sleep, what it actually does is not just goes to sleep, but it will take the contents of RAM and write it out to the hard drive. And then when you wake the machine, it will read the data back, which is nice because if your machine sleeps and then power is mysteriously removed, whatever you've done or whatever is stored in RAM will be gone. So hibernate is good, but the bad news, as we observed here, is that it takes time to both accomplish and recover from when you wake the machine up. So that's what happened, Dave.
Yep.
In my professional opinion, is that the machine somehow thinks it should be hibernating and it should not. And I found another wonderful article here. This is from Thorn Laboratories. I'm finding these really cool blogs, man.
Yeah,
these
that's problems cool.
Here. And basically it's some guy... or laboratory here saying, well, here's something on how to change the hibernate mode with PM set. PM set is power management set.
Yeah,
I think so. That's something in the command line. But basically, you can both read it and set it. And they suggest, and the suggestion here is you should set it, I believe, is zero. Is that right? Will not back up memory to persistent storage is what's listed here.
Well,
so zero is the mode you want. And I think what the mode it's in now is three, which is where it writes stuff out to disk before the machine sleeps.
That's right. That's right. In fact, I think we covered this at TMO too. I think we covered something about
I was looking for
PM
that.
Set. Well, we did in the comments.
Well, there was a more detailed one that talked about how PM set can tell you why bad things happened later.
Right, but then there's this other one where
I missed it. Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
We'll list that one instead.
Well, we'll list them both. There was a thing about it was more of a discussion in the comments about troubleshooting a Mac that wouldn't wake from sleep, but it's all there. We'll relink to all.
Okay. No, I saw that one though. In this case, the machine woke, it just woke slowly.
Right.
So
right.
Maybe we should update that article.
Yep.
But yeah, that's it. Now, I don't know how it happened. And that causes me minor concern is how did the machine all of a sudden decide it should sleep? Unless you maybe played recently with something like Smart Sleep. Which, if you want a commercial commercial solution to manage your sleep and hibernate, then I would certainly recommend that.
Smart Sleep is cool. It's what's cool about it is it's a utility that runs on your Mac and it changes the sleep mode per your settings to depending on how much battery is left and some other factors. So you can be in don't ever hibernate mode. But right, if you get to the point where there's, you know, only 5% of your battery left, then it changes to hibernate mode and you can do some cool things. So, yeah, definitely worth checking
out. And I found
that
useful, Dave, because especially when your machine gets close to the edge as far as battery life.
Yep.
I found in some occasions throughout my Mac, especially Mac portable history, sometimes the machine doesn't guess right and it may shut down.
Well, it, by default,
before it knows to sleep.
If
the calibration is off, and I've had this happen, and that's unpleasant. So that's where Hibernate is better than, you know, the machine just shutting down without sleeping anything, because then you're starting from scratch. So.
Right. Well, what happens is every time your Mac goes to sleep, your laptop goes to sleep, I should say, it's different for desktop Macs. But when your laptops go to sleep, I believe this default behavior will save the hibernation image every single time, but it won't hibernate unless it's, unless the battery is really, really low, and then it'll hibernate to save the battery. But saving that hibernation image takes time, and also, of course, disk space, because it saves an image that equals the amount of RAM that you have, not the amount that you're using, but the amount that you have. So if you have, 8 gigs of RAM in your laptop, it's an 8 gig file that's being written out every time you sleep your Mac. And that may or may not be necessary. And that's what Smart Sleep can take care of for you, is, sort of managing that process. So,
yep,
it is good. It is good.
All right.
All right.
I'm passing the baton to you, my friend.
I tell you what, we're moving fast here. It's good. It's good. It's a Sunday night. It's how we do this. Michael writes, being a researcher, I meticulously organize websites that I bookmark. Basically, I categorize websites into predefined subject folders. The main subject folder is located on Safari's bookmark bar. Currently, I have 10 folders. However, I have hundreds of websites now located within these folders and subfolders. I'm looking for some way to better organize these. For instance, in the Finder, I can add color to files and assign specific names to each color. Or is there a way to locate specific websites I have previously bookmarked? Basically, I need a better way to manage bookmarked websites. All right. Yeah, there's a couple of them out there. Sort of the old standby is one called URL Manager at URL-manager.com. And that's been around for a long time. I'm not convinced it's the best. I will say that I don't use any of these. It will be up to you to decide which is best for you, as always. Another one that comes up quite a bit is pinsapp.com, pinsapp.com. And that one looks cool. It looks very current, has kind of a very modern looking interface, and definitely worth checking out. But the one that really seems to float to the top is called Webla at Celmaro.com, Celmaro.com. And it's way more visual than the others from what I could tell. So I'd never heard of that one at all until I started searching, but it seemed the people that use it seem to love it. So I recommend you check those three out. That's my thought. Do you have any thoughts on this one, John?
I was looking for some online ones, Dave. Mm-hmm. Actually, I found a few here.
Okay.
I think that could be a solution. Actually, I found something here called Google Bookmarks. Oh my gosh, Google's doing everything.
They'll cancel that service. No,
just kidding. Well, they could. Mm-hmm. And then Delicious, I think you may have heard of that. Mm. Is that what it's called? That's another online one. So I'm thinking an online bookmark manager, maybe something to consider. Because It sounds like if you rely on bookmarks a lot, you may want to have them not local. I mean, of course, the nice thing is that if you have iCloud, your bookmarks can be stored. And actually, I take advantage of that I have my Mini, my MacBook Pro, and my iPhone, of course, because they're all tied into iCloud. I have my Safari bookmark list synced among all of them. So that's another thing to consider.
This Webla thing works with Delicious. So it uses Delicious to sync its bookmarks. Right. But it's a more integrated manager, I guess, is the concept. So.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we good on this one?
I think we're great. Well, not great, but yeah, pretty good.
Okay. Pretty good. Pretty good. All right. Well, something, we were talking about Time Machine and how I've been having headaches with it. I'm sort of getting sick of Time Machine, John. It's good, but it causes me a lot of headaches these days. And, it's sort of my it's not my main backup.
I'm tired of I'm tired of the messages saying, it's broken. You're going to have to start from scratch.
Exactly.
I've seen that more and more often, and it, it,
and the
concerns me.
And the you get that, or you get the or you get the message that says, sorry, your disk, your time machine is full, and then you gotta, you know, manage this stuff. It's a headache. It for what for me is sort of my last line of defense. And I've always just left it on because it's there in the OS, but it's gotten to be quite a headache. So so I am very happy, therefore, to have this next sponsor on board, because it's good to have something else that does some of what Time Machine does, and perhaps even more. And that is CrashPlan. CrashPlan.com/MGG is where you would want to visit, because you get a deal. That I'll explain at the end. But CrashPlan is, at its core, built to be an online backup system. And you run an app on your Mac, and it goes through your Mac and packs everything up to back it up. And it backs it up to CrashPlan's cloud. It does it securely. You can choose your level of security. You can use your own key that they don't have access to and would never be able to get at your data, whether you want them to or not. And that's an important thing. Or you can use their key, which is protected by your password, but they could get at your data if you wanted them to. And that could be helpful if you lost your key. But the idea is you install this on your Mac, and it goes through and it backs stuff up. And then as you make changes to your data, it backs those up too, and keeps versions and all of that good stuff in the cloud. You can pull your data back down to your same Mac, a different Mac, or even to your iOS devices with their iOS apps. And it's, you know, I've been using CrashPlan for, well, I just had to renew, so well over a year, because I had a little demo account going, and then I got a real one, and here we are. So what's cool about it is you can use it on, they're multi-platform. You know, you could use it on your Windows machines. You can use it on your Mac. You can even use it on Linux, although that's supported in a limited capacity officially. They're actually totally cool with you using it on Linux, but I have to tell you that, you know, their official support for it is not there, but I have actually had them give me support for it on Linux, and they didn't know that I was, you know, me. So they treated me like they would have anybody else, which is kind of how I like to deal with customer service. Great stuff. And then they've got this cool thing where you can do backups to, you could actually use it to backup locally. So I could have, you know, I could hang a big fat drive off of one of my Macs here at home and have all of my Macs backup to that locally. So now it's going faster because it's not going over the internet. And also my data is being kept here at home, but I could also have John backup to that big fat drive, or John could set up a drive at his house and I could backup to that at his house. And you can do this. You can have multiple backups going all from the same CrashPlan setup. Really easy to use, has been very reliable for me. And I'm happy to have them on board as a sponsor. I would actually recommend them whether they were a sponsor or not. And I love to be able to say that. And that's CrashPlan. But if you visit CrashPlan.com/MGG, you'll actually get 15% off a 1-year subscription. And depending on how many computers you want to back up, you know, that could save you quite a bit of money. And so I highly recommend you check it out. CrashPlan.com/MGG. Anything else, John, on that one? I know you are on and off a CrashPlan user, but
I'm off right now.
You're off right now.
When it was on, it was cool.
That. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good. And it gives me that versioning that I didn't get with or that I will miss when I don't use Time Machine. On at least half of my computers right now, Time Machine is non-functional and hasn't backed up for months because it's like complaining, like you said, about, you know, it's corrupt or there's not room, or it's like, come on. This is supposed to be for everyone to use. I have to be more of a geek to use Time Machine and keep it working than I do to use CrashPlan. I know they're paying us to talk about CrashPlan, but that's true. It's just, that's a statement born of frustration, not of greed.
All I know is CrashPlan, when I was using it, the only time I would get a notification. So it would pretty much work in the background and you know, any tool that I'd like to use,
yeah,
when it's working, it just works and you don't have to worry about it. When something's wrong, it'll notify you. And it did. Like I remember like when we had the, you know, Sandy and all that, that terrible stuff when, you know, none of my computers were backing up because there was no electricity and no internet. On my other devices, I actually send a little notification saying, hey, you know what? I noticed I haven't seen you for a while. You know, what's up? Which to me, that's an outstanding feature. And then it notices.
Only Time Machine had that.
Well, it, and yeah, and you're right. It doesn't say, hey, I haven't backed up for a week. Maybe something's wrong somewhere else. Can you look into it? Whereas Crash Plan does.
Yep. So there you go. All right. I have a, we have a question that's, well, not really related to Crash Plan, but it's related to sending data securely. And it, it's sort of interesting how this came in and then some other information came in, but we'll answer the question.
I have more information.
I know. And I'm hoping you do because I don't quite have, I think I have, actually, I think now I do have an answer. Okay. So Eric writes, he says, I am becoming increasingly interested in using FTP tools to transfer large amounts of data to other people. What Mac and or iOS apps do you recommend? What are some considerations with different options? And I asked him to go a little deeper into this because he, you know, was very specific to ask about FTP versus just sort of a generic thing. And so his answer was a large, he says, my objective or use case for this is to create a single connection session, unlike continually sharing a huge Dropbox folder filled with pictures between my Mac and another machine in which I can securely transfer a ton of data. And he's saying, you know, greater than 2 gigs at a shot. Dropbox and other cloud services have nice share features, but at times I just want to send data that's not on my Dropbox, like a home movie file. In addition, my Dropbox account is only 3 gigs in size. My limited research indicates that security features can be weak in many protocols that I was checking out. My ideal solution would include a third-party app that installs on both Mac and Windows. Encrypted transfer could be enabled as the connections are made. An iOS component would be great, too. All right, John. So I like this question, but off the top of my head, I didn't have any straight answer. So I'm actually very curious as to what you have. And then we have something tangentially related that we'll talk about too.
So the requirement here is to have a secure file transfer service. Well, FTP is swell, but here's the only problem. FTP is not secure.
Correct.
But as you probably know, Dave, there is a secure version of FTP called SFTP.
Yeah, which actually isn't FTP anymore. It's just sending data over a secure shell connection, but it's called SFTP. So yeah. But it deals with it differently.
But that's what I was going to suggest.
There you go.
Now, you may ask yourself, is SFTP included in macOS 10?
Absolutely.
And I think you almost answered the question, Dave, because I did find a swell article here. So one thing I'm going to suggest. So I found a nice article at OS X Daily kind of going over this. And here's the bonus. If you have macOS X, you have an SFTP server, but it is hidden.
Go.
Now, the thing is, throughout the evolution of macOS X, they started removing things. For example, there is no longer in the file sharing part. So if you go to System Preferences, Sharing.
Right.
You will no longer see FTP. It is not offered as an option. Now, there's a way to enable it, but you know, you want to enable FTP. It's insecure. Wouldn't it be nice to enable SFTP?
As a server? Yeah, of course.
And how do you do this, Dave? Now, the thing is, when I look in the list of services I can share here.
Oh, remote login.
In the latest OS, there's DVD, there's script, there's file sharing, but no, it doesn't list it. Oh, but there's remote login.
Yeah.
And guess what? And this is what I found in this article, Dave. If you enable remote login, which is normally SSH, you also enable an SFTP server that is built into macOS 10.
Well, it's the same server, right? It happens over the SSH connection. Totally makes sense. So
exactly. And to test this, and the article does this, and this is where I got all kind of giggly here, is that if you enable remote login and then you say SFTP in the terminal space localhost or 127.001, it'll be like, oh, hi, how's it going? Oh, yeah, there's a SRSA fingerprint. I'm not sure who you are. Are you sure you want to continue? That's basically the beginning of a secure exchange. And that after you do that, as far as I know, Dave, you then have on that machine an SFTP server, and then you can do a SFTP client either, you know, from the command line, which is unpleasant often, or the client that I still use, Dave, for a lot of file transfer is CyberDuck. And CyberDuck has a SFTP mode.
Okay.
So that is my suggestion for a free built-in secure file transfer capability within at least the Mac.
All right. So I'm going to poke some holes in this to, just to create some conversation here. You're absolutely right. And SFTP is a good protocol to use because it's on a proven platform. It's an open source platform, which means we know that the connection is actually secure and is not, you know, some third party hidden security that we don't actually know. And, you know, it's been vetted. So and it's updated when there's problems found. So SFTP is good. But it comes with a couple of problems. Number one is when you connect from, you know, your client Mac to the server Mac, how do you log in? Well, you have to log in using a user account that exists on that Mac. There's no way to say, like, right, if I want to let you log in, I have to either create an account for you or give you my credentials. Right. And then when you upload, you only have access to, you know, the folders that are yours if your user account. So it would work, but it's non-optimal for two friends want to send a file.
Well, it's extra work. Yeah, it's not plug and play.
It's not plug it. There you go. Thank you. So the person
setting up the server would have to do additional work to enable this and to create an account for the person who wants to get the stuff. I agree.
Yep. And then the other thing is, you know, when you start your SFTP server on your Mac, it doesn't poke a hole in your firewall. So if someone remotely wants to, you know, if I wanted you to get in, I'd have to go and create the right port mapping so that SFTP ports on the, you know, on the router get routed to my Mac and all of that. Again, totally doable, totally sound concept, but not entirely, like you said, not plug and play. Okay. So I really, off the top of my head, I don't have a plug and play solution. What I started thinking of is, does Transmit manage any of this? Transmit from Panic Software. And it's a client, but I don't think it's a server. So, it does not, I don't think it does. It would be great if it did because I love Panic and I love Panic. They make great software, but I love Transmit and we use it. It's part of my workflow because it's Apple scriptable and it's got it's actually automatable. So I use it as part of our workflow every week to upload the podcast.
You know, I'm looking at them and they say Panic Transmit, the ultimate Mac OS X FTP and SFTP app.
Yeah, but it's client.
So does it serve it?
I don't think so. No. So what else do we do? And I don't know the answer, and I haven't looked in the chat room yet. Kiwi Graham is saying, check out LogMeIn. And that's actually not a bad idea. That might be a way. I was thinking remote access, but that gets weird with Windows and all of that. But, you know, something that's already going to traverse the firewall, and sort of do some of that work.
The other would be, I'm almost positive it does this, but TeamViewer, which we talked about before, TeamViewer is typically a remote access application, which is almost plug and play in that there is a version. I remember we talked about this before, but they have an installer that basically starts their client, brings it up and says, okay, here's some magic numbers. Tell the person at the other end to enter these. And then you have remote control, but also you can do file transfer. And it's using FTTP. So TeamViewer, I remember trying it once for file transfer and it's like, oh yeah, it does that too. That's kind of cool. It's not its primary purpose, but a team viewer may be worth a look as well.
Yep. Okay. All right, cool. So that's that. I'm busy editing our show notes and putting all this stuff in. It's not that, because there is another thing we got a lot of email about this week. Pilot Pete, I think you were the first one to tell me about it, but I mean, it was of all the things we heard about this week, this was the one we heard about the most. And it's something called, where I'm looking for it here. It's something called BitTorrent Sync. And
what?
Aren't
they criminals?
Oh, no, no. BitTorrent's
isn't
actually
BitTorrent just for bad people.
Not necessarily. Bad people use it a lot.
I know.
It's very handy.
It's good technology that can be used for bad things.
Yeah. But what they've done is they've created using the BitTorrent tech and file transfer protocols. They've built this thing that's essentially like a Dropbox, right? If your Mac is on and my Mac is on, John, and we're both running the BitTorrent sync client, and we both have given each other access to this folder, and there's an easy process that you go through for each folder that you want to sync, it just magically will sync these folders between our two Macs securely. And it's cool because you can create, like, I can have, we set up our folder, and I can create a key that you can use, and now the folder is, you know, totally fine, but you can have a read-only key, a read-write key, and you can even have a temporary key that's good for like 24 hours. So it's good. It looks cool. I've played with it a little bit. Pilot Pete, and I guess I set up a folder for the three of us, John. I don't know if you'd put anything in it yet, but it's interesting. Again, it's, you know, people are saying it's going to kill Dropbox. I'm not entirely convinced of that because it works great, but it requires your computer to be on in order to get this data. Now, or one of the computers that's in the, you know, that's sharing this one particular folder to be on. Dropbox, of course, has their own stuff in the cloud, you know. So, I mean, it's interesting. It's very much in a test mode. It's available for free, but you know, so there you go. BitTorrent sync. It's worth checking out. It looks cool. So that's not entirely what Eric's looking for, because he didn't want something that just always shares, but this might be the simplest solution for you, because you can just put something in, build a shared folder between you and whoever it is you want to send stuff to. You put something in that folder and boom, it automatically shares it with them. And you can just call them up and tell them, hey, this file's in your folder, go drag it out, go do whatever you want with it. And you're good to go. So you don't, you know, it allows for asynchronous file transfers, which is a hugely convenient thing. So, you know, there you go. BitTorrent sync. What do you think, John?
Yep.
All right. So I would have called that a cool stuff found thing if we were doing cool stuff found. And while we're at it, I am going to throw in a cool stuff found thing, John, because I'm not going to wait on this one for the next show, the next cool stuff found show we do. We were talking about using our car's ODB ports in various ways. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, this thing came out this week called Automatic. It's at automatic.com, and it's worth watching their little video. But the concept is you plug this little device into your car's ODB port and it stays there full time. And it's and then you install an app on your iPhone, and it's not out yet. It's coming out late summer, early fall. Your iPhone syncs up with it, and it does a couple of things, and it could wind up doing even more. First, it will mark your location when your phone will mark your location when you get out of the car, so you always know where you parked your car, which, you know, handy little thing. But it also, while you're driving, it monitors your driving, and you can set it, you know, I want to be more economical, and you can set it to give you little alerts, like when you're driving in a way that's burning more fuel or less fuel. And it's totally real time information being communicated to you. Can give you a little alert. Oh, don't accelerate so quickly. Don't do this, you know, and maybe you can even save some money. Right. My son said it best.
Virtual backseat driver.
Well, yes. Right. But my son said it best when he said it's a Fitbit for your car. It's like, oh, what a brilliant way to call, you know, what a brilliant way to kind of encapsulate that, because that's what it's doing. It's monitoring what you're doing all the time and then giving you some information. You do whatever you want with the information, but, you know, at least you're getting this data. And then also, if you've got when the check engine light comes on, it'll translate what's going on and tell you specifically, here's the issue. And if you fix the issue, you can even use this thing to clear the check engine light on your own. And I think they're selling it for like $70. So cool stuff. Very, very cool. And a great domain name. I wonder what they paid for automatic.com. That would be an interesting little tidbit on the side.
Can I get this or no? It's only for ODB.
Check it out. They say that it'll work with every car since, I think long before yours.
Now I see in our article.
Yep.
1996.
And what year is your car?
94.
So it has to be ODB2.
Yes.
Got it.
There was ODB1, then 1.5 and 2, and 2 started in 96. So I was just a little bit behind the curve.
Yep. Yeah.
Though it has some capabilities. Oh, well. So.
Yeah. So cool stuff.
What's happening here?
I don't know what's happening here, John.
What do you got? Bob. Well, there's Bob. You want to? I got some Bob. Thoughts on the Bobster.
All right.
I hope he doesn't mind that.
I think it's
Bob-a-rama.
Making copies.
Dave is, of course, referring to, I think it was a Joe. Who was the actor?
Rob.
SNL.
Yeah, it was on SNL. Yeah. Yeah.
No, who was the guy? Was it I'm trying to remember the actor, but yeah, it was like making copies and a copier.
Yep.
Copy-rama. Thought it was Joe something, but yeah, it'll come to me at some point.
I thought his name was Rob something or else. I don't know. Bob writes, you guys talk extensively about cloud storage and the security of files stored there. Do you have any recommendations for encryption apps or encrypted storage? For sharing, it would be nice to have a password-protected space or an encryption method that works on both Mac and Windows and iOS. John, I serve this one up to you.
Well, I'm going to have at least one view on this, Dave, here. So how do you store data securely in the cloud? Well, one thing I would recommend, which, you know, for people with not a lot of money to spend here, which is something free, Dave.
Yeah.
Is a secure disk image. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've talked about that before.
Will that work on
Windows?
That's
okay. Well, you're reading my mind here. Okay. So that is a great solution. So if you're talking an all Mac group here, then what you can do is this utility does allow you to create a secure or encrypted disk image. So that would certainly be one way to store your data securely in the cloud. Now, another one, Dave, and this is something that I have written an article about, but I found this to be good, depending on how you use it, will do cross-platform secure storage, and that is TrueCrypt.
Mm.
Remember them?
I do, yeah.
But one thing, and I actually remember doing this when I was testing it and kicking the tires on it, is that depending on the mode, I think what you have to do is you have to choose a secure file option here. So they have a number of ways to secure your content here, but if you use their program, the file that is encrypted, last I looked at them, is usable by multiple platforms. So it's a TrueCrypt is something to look at, and I'm not sure about what's the other one. I think Pilot Pete uses it. Norton, I'm not sure if they if their security software is.
No, I think TrueCrypt was what Pete used. I think so. He's in the chat room. He'll tell us if we're, I think he's still in the chat room.
Yeah. All right. But I think TrueCrypt is a good place to look. It's open source. It's a security software that lets you secure a partition. Or I think on the file level, I think that's the important thing here is that you can then go between platforms because the secure file is created by TrueCrypt.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And that's a smart thing because data, I mean, you use something like Dropbox, right? And the data is being sent securely and presumably, and they're unclear on this, but it probably being stored encrypted. But the key for that encryption for Dropbox, and the same is true currently anyway of SugarSync, is that the key belongs to them. So they could unencrypt your data. I you know, it's what I call secure until a subpoena, right? Although
I'm almost sure they all do this. So in theory, what they could do, Dave, is use your password as the encryption key. But I think what they do instead by default is they use their secret key to encrypt the content. So when they say they encrypt the content, they're not misleading you. But as you say, if someone, you know, bangs on their door and says, well, we need to look at Dave Hamilton's you know, encrypted content, they'll be like, yeah, well, we got the key.
So. Yeah, well, and I will say, you know, I mentioned this to the folks. I have tried to talk to Dropbox about this and they're like totally lip shut about it, which is stupid. But I talked to the people at SugarSync about it and they said
they should be open about this discussion because it concerns a lot of people.
Yeah. And they said they agreed 100%. They're like, you're absolutely right. We have the key. However, And they said, you know, they sort of chuckled about my secure until a subpoena. They're like, that's actually a great way to say it. They said, but it's not just until a subpoena. It's until we lose the fight about the subpoena. They said we've gotten four of them. Now, this was as of March, I think. They said we've gotten four of them. We have fought every one of those subpoenas. And in all four cases, no one has gotten access to the data. So that was good to hear. I mean, it's no guarantees that they're going to, you know, fight and win on your behalf. But it was not, you know, that's a nice little bit of customer service. So there you go. But if you store it on a TrueCrypt drive, sure enough, you know, SugarSync Dropbox could unencrypt the data that you've sent them and find this secure this disk image. But they couldn't get into that because they don't have your key. I hope that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And the best security, of course, Dave, as I've heard it said by a lot of people, the most secure computer is one that is not connected to a network.
Absolutely right.
And don't laugh, but...
No, that's how it works. I mean, yeah. And if you think the government doesn't know that, you know, you're wrong, because they have plenty of data that's not connected for exactly.
Well, you probably saw the articles recently. It was like some FBI guy said, oh, yeah, we got recordings of all phone calls made in the U.S. If we wanted to get them, we could.
Yeah.
It's like, all right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Who watches the watchers, Dave? That's my question.
I do. It's my secret
good.
Job.
Oh, what is next?
I want to, you know what's next?
Who is next?
That question reminds me, I want to find what I'm supposed to watch, right? I like the X-Files. I know this is a tangent, but I like the X-Files, loved that show, right? Yeah, it got a little crazy toward the end. It wasn't that great. And then Fringe took over, right? I mean, years later.
Same thing. Fringe was awesome, and then it got not so great towards the end, in my personal opinion.
But it fed that one thing. So I guess you and
paranormal.
I have to...
Paranormal.
Yeah.
Paranormal or government conspiracy TV show. We need another one because, yeah, I mean, there was the shadow government in X-Files.
Right.
And Fringe as well. There was this part of the government that was working against whatever.
Yeah. So we need to come up with another show. Maybe that's what we do, John. Maybe that's the next thing you and I do together. I mean, we won't stop Matt Geekab. Don't worry, folks. But I think, John, you and I are going to have to write a TV show.
Well, you and I should get on the horn to JJ then, right?
No, forget JJ. He doesn't know how to kill anybody. People that he kills always come back to life. They always come back to life. That's my problem with JJ Abrams. He can't kill people.
Or Whedon. Or Joss.
Why do we have to call them? We do it ourselves. We'll make the money.
Crowdsource it.
That's it. We'll just organize it. Yeah, it doesn't have to be just ours. We'll open arms on this one. We can do this. Maybe we'll even get the guys from No Agenda in on it. They're tuned into this stuff. So, all right. Anyway, Floris, before we get too crazy here, Floris writes, I have two Macs, a 2008 G5 and a 2011 iMac, both with updated Mountain Lion. I don't think your 2008's a G5 because it couldn't run Mountain Lion, right? Anyway, he says, on my iMac, when I go to any what type of computer it is irrelevant for this, by the way. On my iMac, when I go to any file in the Finder and right-click on it and go to the Share submenu, there is an email function. On my other computer, I do not have an email function. And he sent us a screenshot, and sure enough, it says, you know, message, Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, no email. Very frustrating. I've Googled it, tried a couple things, like creating an automator workflow, but that's a hassle. I don't want to always drag the file to the mail app icon. Any ideas how to get it back? I know exactly how to get it back. I think I have exactly the answer, John.
Really?
I do. Yep.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, sometimes, every now and then, you know, we hit one out of the park.
But that's a fairly, to review, that's a fairly recent menu, which is mirroring iOS functionality, and that a lot of iOS messages, if you click on a certain button, will say, hey, you want to share it with iMessage, Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, all this stuff. It's interesting the parity that we're getting between the operating systems now with the share thing. And I think it's pretty much even right now, right?
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah. But I know the answer. I know how to make this work.
How?
If you go into Mail, go to Preferences, and the first tab is the General tab, and the first thing that's listed is the default email reader. My guess is that you installed some third-party thing to check your email or something like that. And in order to get the share menu to show email, mail has to be listed by the system as the default email reader. And I bet if you go and turn that on or set it to that, that it will be there. Now, you may have some third party app, again, like that Gmail checker thing or whatever, that you set is the default so that it works in a different way. And you have there's a trade off there. You've got to have mail as the default one if you want this. So you get to pick. But that's 99% of the time. That's the solution to that little problem. It's weird what things rely, you know, how all the hooks work. That's what we're always looking for, is the needle in the haystack. Right. So,
and, you know, I'm looking at this, Dave, and oh, my gosh. So, number one, I've never clicked on this menu because I never needed to. But number two, I'm looking here and almost all of the apps listed are Parallels mappings.
Oh,
which actually is a minor fish shake that I have at Parallels, and that I'm sure, yeah, I can turn it off. But Parallels will put Windows applications in a lot of Mac menus, which if you're big on Windows, Mac interoperability is great. But in this case, again, I'm seeing like 50 things listed here and only one of them is a Mac application.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know. I hate that too, actually. I love Parallels, but I don't need it to infra. I keep my Parallels world separate from my Mac world, and I don't need them overly integrated. I need to share files between them and pretty much, you know, stay out. That's kind of how that's how I go. But but yeah, I think you can turn that off. But by default, it's on. It you know, plows all that stuff into your system. All right. John, we got a tip from show 446. In fact, we got a couple of tips, but we go ahead and we talked about converting songs to MP3 format without having them clutter up the iTunes library, right? We were talking about converting to MP3 so that we could put it on a flash drive to be used in the car or whatever. So, but we got some, and we had some solutions and using third party apps, and then we got some emails from people. So take one of them. I think his name was Dave.
Well, Dave, we have one from Dave. Hi, Dave and John, Dave says. I think I got the right one here.
Yeah, you
thank
got the
you
right
so
one.
Much for doing. Thank you so much for doing what you do. You're welcome. I love the show and I've learned a lot over the years. I want to take a second chime in on the issue from 446 about converting AAC songs to MP3 for the car's hard drive and then dealing with the resulting duplicates. What I would suggest is to simply create a new smart playlist in iTunes with the following criteria. Date added is at least in the last one day, and kind contains MPEG. This will reveal the MP3s that were just created from the convert process. Select all and option delete to remove them from the library. Done.
That's brilliant. It's great. Okay. But that, right? I mean, because that way you don't need third-party software. You're doing it. I will... We had somebody on Twitter, Bill on Twitter, in fact, sent us what effectively is the same solution, but automated and pre-written for you. If you go to DougScripts.com and find the convert and export script, which of course we will put in the show notes, that will do, it will do the same thing. My guess is it does it in probably the same way, but it does it in an automated way. So you just run, you highlight the songs, you run the script, and it does it and spits them out and then deletes them from iTunes. So, so that's, you know, there you go. Right.
Chew them up, spit them out.
That's what we do. That's how we roll. And I think if that's how we roll, I think it is time to, you know, to roll on out of here, John.
Or rock.
We like to rock. It's one of my favorite things to do. In fact,
we like to roll, but we also like to do is to hear your comments, your questions, and your various, irrelevant tangents.
It's
not that you have those, but that other guy or gal does.
Yes.
So, how do you get in touch with us? I would, I'd probably pick up the phone and call 206-666-GEEK, which is...
It is 4335. That's what I'd do. Or you could email us, feedback@macgeekab.com.
And what Dave said was feedback@macgeekab.com.
And if feedback@macgeekab.com is not the right thing for you, you can Skype us a voicemail to, as you might have guessed, MacGeekab. But John, there's more. You can find us on Twitter. How? Where? What do we do?
If you're on the Twitters, do you even know what Twitter is, people? If you don't, well, you go to Twitter.com. You can send messages. You can receive them. You can do both. It's amazing. And you have to have a handle or ID on Twitter. I am John Efron. He is Dave Hamilton. The other guy who's flying around, but he's in the chat room, which is so awesome, is Pilot Pete on Twitter. Then we also have Mackie Gab and Mac Observer all on Twitter.
And you can join
but
us.
There's also the, I'm sorry, but the Facebooks.
Yeah, go ahead and talk about the Facebook. That's fine.
Well, the Facebook, just like the Twitters, we got the Facebooks. We have it all. And on Facebook, you go to facebook.com/Mackie Gab. You can learn about when the next show is coming up, when the show notes are posted, and just general discussion and banter among all the people that are part of the show.
It's fun. It's great having all of you in the chat room. It has changed the show. I think it's changed the show for all of us, the people in the chat room and the people not in the chat room, because what it provides is real-time feedback for things that would, well, frankly, when we get something wrong, it's awesome to have the chat room because you're all right there and you tell us, hey, whoa.
When was the last time we got something wrong?
I think it happens more than you might think, you know, but it's nice having that, you know, especially with Pilot Pete's work schedule, not allowing him to kind of be here as that sanity check of some of this stuff. It's nice to sort of crowdsource that. And it makes the show better because it means we don't have to wait a week to read the email and say, oh, yep, we got to, you know, offer this little tweak. And then it's not in context. And if somebody hears one show but not the follow up, you know, it makes it better. It's great. And it's fun, you know. So we appreciate it. You don't have to come. Obviously, you can listen to the show and most of you don't come to the chat room, and that's okay. But yeah, MackieCab.com/stream.
But where you should go,
John, I will.
Every now and then.
Go ahead.
Every now and then, you probably should go to iTunes and go to Mackie Gab and offer a comment.
We do like the positive comments there in iTunes. Yeah. Well, we like all the comments.
Well, but everybody. Yeah. Everybody likes positive comments.
Yeah, we do. That's right. Well, but, you know, here's the thing. The positive comments actually help boost the rating of the show, and it gets us featured more, and that's always a good thing. So we definitely appreciate that.
And the negative causes us to, you know, get a posse together to kind of deal with the situation, right?
Yeah, well, look, if you have a negative comment, feel free to post it there. But also, we can't reply to you there, and we often don't know who you are. We can't figure that out. So if you do have something, you know, that you want to take up with us, email us directly so that we can actually interact with you and you know.
And we've had some fish shakes. Oh, some deserve some.
Of course. I'm sure we deserve fish shakes.
Not.
That's right.
Right.
John, I do want to, before we wrap this up, I will yes. show you yet another benefit of the chat room. To turn off those things in parallels, Grumpy115 says, go into parallels, go to the preferences, go to options, go to applications, and say turn off share apps. And that will keep those things showing up.
I knew there was something.
Yep.
It's certainly convenient, but yeah, it was overwhelming my system, especially for audio or video files.
Yeah.
When I was playing videos, it'd be like, yeah, you want to run QuickTime from Windows to play this? And I'm like,
no.
And sometimes I'd accidentally click on it, and then it would launch Parallels and launch QuickTime Player in Windows, which is silly if it's on my Mac.
Right. So, yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. All right. And with that, it's time to... time to see this one off. We do first, though, want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast and GetAppler.com. Check that out if you haven't. Great way to track your iOS apps that you own and also see what apps other people have that might have the same apps that you do and read reviews. It's a great little interactive community that and it's actually not so little. It's growing fairly well. So check it out. GetAppler.com. GetAppler.com. Of course, CashFly, CashFly.com, provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes BB Edit from Barebones Software, Text Expander from Smile, Gazelle.com to sell your Macs and iOS devices, Squarespace.com, of course, and CrashPlan.com/MGG, all through Backbeat Media. And I will share this one last thing with you.
Really?
Yeah, I will. You know, it's what we do. We share advice and tips and tricks and cool stuff found. I did find one thing cool this week, John. It was really important. It was good advice. Don't get caught.